not just the examples that people set for me. There are people in here who actually hired me and trained me on jobs since I've been sober. And fortunately, there are none in here that fired me before I got sober. Anyway, it's good to be home. I'm going to make this painless as possible. I understand there's some terrible nicotine addicts here, and I came in Alcoholics Anonymous in a time when they still had 12-step calls, and when they still had social detox. And I have seen the second step happen right in meetings, and especially over at Crawford Center in Greensboro. And one morning we were sitting there at a meeting, and I knew this guy kind of looked like he hadn't took step two. He also hadn't completed detox. About halfway through the meeting, he falls out the chair, starts foaming at the mouth and mumbling in the spirit. Two or three guys on the front row took step two right there. You know, so I don't want you withdrawing from nicotine in here. I'm going to be through in an hour. You know, just be patient. We get it done by 9 o'clock. I'm just glad to be here. I'm looking forward to enjoying a wonderful weekend with you, and I'm looking forward to hearing some people that I've wanted to hear again for a long time. And I am so grateful that the committee asked me to share this weekend with you. I really do appreciate it. And I'll tell you, it took being invited to Funfest to get a meal out of Sterling. I ain't sure he's paying for it yet. So I appreciate y'all making him feed me. I think I've deserved that for quite some time. Anyway, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous a long time before I wanted to get here. I didn't want to be here until after I got here. I knew I needed to be here, and I didn't like being here. But this is one of the few places I've been where I knew that I belonged the moment I got here. Now, I didn't necessarily like that. I got introduced to some people that I didn't think liked me, and I didn't like them. I watched them watch me for 9 months. I didn't make a whole lot of progress. Met these guys in Greensboro, and they were old guys. They just seemed so old to me, you know. Sitting around, all of them, I think all of them had at least a 42 waist. Some of them wore bib overalls. And they always sat against the wall. I didn't think they could set up straight without leaning against their wall. These guys were old. And they just seemed, you know, I was perfectly convinced that they sat around all day. And they didn't work either. I think most of them retired. I think some of them just quit, you know. And I was perfectly convinced that they sit around all day thinking up painful stuff to hurt my feelings. And that's what they did. They just sat around, and for young men who were right on the threshold of sobriety, they'd say stuff to hurt their feelings and trip them up. And they'd say stuff like, I remember one night we was complaining about DWIs, and this old guy says, you know, I ain't been caught driving drunk since I quit drinking. That was profound. I had never connected the two, you know. I mean, I said, man, I sneaked on to the bathroom and wrote that one down. I said, man, I'm going to use that across town next week, you know. But these guys begin to love me in a way that baffled me. Wasn't used to that. They were not intimidated by me. They love me enough to tell me the truth. And that's what I like about AA, good old pure AA. And see, when they ain't got your insurance money and your mom and daddy's money, they ain't got to talk to your HMO every 3 days. They can talk to you in a language that you understand. And I understood what they were talking about. I was reading a little bit of Big Book today. There's a line in there that I like on... I ain't going to tell you what page it is. But you spend the rest of this meeting saying, I wonder if you know what page that is. But it says in there that they outline a spiritual answer, and program of action. And that's what these guys did for me. These guys got me started. They said, as a matter of fact, back then, they didn't tell you not to drink and go to meetings. They didn't just tell you 90 and 90. They told you not to drink and told you exactly what meetings to go to because they planned on showing up there, too, and they did. So you couldn't lie about it. They sent me to four speaker meetings a week, and they let me go to one discussion meeting. Of course, they didn't give me the liberty of saying anything. Told me I needed to listen. And I'll tell you, I really do appreciate that now. I needed so much to hear the whole story. I needed to hear how it was, what happened, and how it happened today. I needed to hear the problem, you know, the onset, the problem, and the solution. Now, what happened is, I begin to know that I belonged here. Now, I didn't know a whole lot about these steps. Didn't want to know anything about the steps. Didn't know anything about how to stop drinking. But I'll tell you what I knew. I knew I had felt like you felt. I had behaved like you had behaved. I had drank like you drank. And I knew that I needed to be here, whether I liked it or not. And just hanging around, I began to get to know you and begin to know a little bit about me. And, you know, I guess you can talk to the committee after I get through, but they knew I had some opinions when I came up here. You know, I got to express my opinion. Might not get to do it no more. You know, it didn't take me long to learn that in Alcoholics Anonymous, that when if you're sober and been sober a little while you're black, and you're 6'4", and you weigh 260 pounds, you can have an opinion if you want to. So I express it every now and then, you know. One of my opinions is I believe that I am sober today by the grace of a loving God who manifests himself in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a continuously growing circle of friends like yourself. And I meet them at every meeting I go to. And that circle widens every time I do those things that Alcoholics Anonymous suggests I do. Another one of my opinions is that I can't expect to get what the big book suggests I'll get if I don't do what the fifth chapter suggests I do. Now, it worked, I don't know how it works for other people. But it didn't start getting better with Dennis Nance until he started following some instructions and taking some action. And that's what happened. Now, that was hard. That was pretty difficult for me to do. Because I think I was just born with the natural desire not to follow instructions. I don't like doing what I'm told. I don't like, there's one sure way to get me to sabotage myself. Let's tell me what to do. See, I'll do the opposite just to prove to you I can. And my whole life has been like that. I was born on a 13-acre cotton farm, didn't like that. I started wearing glasses when I was 5 years old, didn't like that. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know I couldn't see. I was doing good until they put these glasses on my face. I said, wow. So this is the way it is. It's kind of like getting sober at the age of 5, you know. These old welfare glasses with those loose hinges on them, you know, you still couldn't see, you know. And then you got these crooked glasses on. And then Dad tops that off with one of these good old bootleg at-home Sears and Roebuck Clippers one-sided haircuts that he's getting. And, you know, I was thinking about that this afternoon. It looks like he cut my hair today. I was paying for these haircuts these days. You know? And back then, I was getting them for nothing and complaining about it. So I'm 5 years old, I'm already looking weird. And these girls mess with me all the time. I had five sisters and had three of them before I had my brother. And I didn't know any better. I was pretty dumb. I have to tell you the truth. I was dumb and stayed little for a long time. I tell you, those girls used to whoop on me up pretty bad, too, you know. But they'd be painting their fingernails on Saturday nights, you know. And they say, can I do that? I said, no, you can't do that. But boys don't paint their fingernails. And then Linda was smart. She said, well, Dennis, boys paint their thumbnails. Stick them out there. Do it to me. You know. I get to Sunday school, and here I am sitting up with this one-sided haircut, crooked glasses, and two red thumbs. You know? Man, I'm waiting for the Spirit to come. You know? It don't take long to figure that one out. I can't change these glasses and this haircut, but is that 10 minutes after Sunday school started, I got red lips, too, because I'm eating that thing there probably now. You know? I'm trying to look normal. I think I spent the rest of my life trying to look normal. That was the good parts about being raised in Shelby, though. Dad was superintendent of Sunday school, and a lot bigger than me. And I was introduced to what I believe now to be the same principles that you're teaching me in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I was taught those in the basement of Shoal Creek Baptist Church. But for some reason, I didn't grasp them then. I think the primary reason I did not grasp those principles then is because I did not have that sense of desperation that I had when I was introduced to you. But I think what that did is prepared me for it. I think the thing that has helped me acclimate to Alcoholics Anonymous is that Alcoholics Anonymous contain the principles that I believe in anyway. Now, back then, I think I have always done the right thing for the wrong reason or the wrong thing for the right reason, but it just never did work out right. And I believe that even in the basement of Shoal Creek Baptist Church, I sat there and used that excellent spiritual indoctrination to get sicker. Because even in the basement of that church, I began to perfect the very character defects that would keep me consumed by alcoholism for years. And I'll tell you what I did. I learned how to manipulate people. I learned how to look like you wanted me to look, say what you wanted me to say, and act like you wanted me to act until you quit looking. Then I did what I wanted to do. Of course, I got thumped a lot, you know, but that didn't keep me from doing it. But Dad had those big, long arms and fat fingers on the end of them. My hand's not big as his, but now, you know, you ever look at National Geographic and see the way they put it in slow motion, the way a frog catches a fly, his tongue just unrolls and catches that fly and zips back in there? Well, Dad could thump like that. You never seen him. He just twitched. He said, "Oh, yeah." You know. When you watch Star Trek, it's like you got phased, you know. But that didn't stop. So the other thing I learned in Sunday school is I learned to memorize stuff. And that memory today is probably, I think, my worst liability, especially when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, that memory and that ability to manipulate people are probably the worst two liabilities I have. Because, see, I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous a while. And after you're around a while, you can go to that meeting feeling miserable, know you need to call that sponsor and don't do it, and you walk on in, and they say, "Well, how you doing?" I say, "Well, I'm doing all right, you know, doing fine. You came here, just zip right on by." Get in the meeting and sit there on that stuff and share something intellectual rather than tell you how I really feel. And that memory. You know what the memory does to us. Mike didn't read it, but we read it back in traditional. You hear it read a lot. You know, that fifth chapter doesn't say, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly memorized our book." It says, "Follow the path." See, my problem is I never want to do anything. I'll tell you how much I know, but I ain't about to tell you how I feel. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous is important. You know, another thing that's important to me is to have people that miss me when I'm not there and know when there's something wrong. I see, that's why I need Alcoholics Anonymous. But if I don't, those two liabilities will eat me up again. Another good thing about Shelby I like is, you know, I guess we were too poor back then to know about the civil rights movement. We missed the whole civil rights movement because we was out there picking cotton. And at 6 o'clock, you know, the news comes on. I'm in the cotton field. I don't know about Martin Luther. I missed him, you know. But you know, back then, I think things were more integrated than they are now. And I remember one of the things I really liked is the Sunday afternoons we used to have back then. We'd go to church, and on Sunday afternoon we'd go behind Miss Wittenberg's house and home back down in the woods, and we'd meet Jack and Michael Hamrick and some of the Mother and Lights guys, and you know, just white kids and black kids, and about this time of year, a little earlier, we'd be up in the muscadine tree. Man, there'd be so many kids up there of all kind of colors. The tree would look like a Christmas tree. A black kid on this limb, white kid on that limb. We never thought about it. On any given Saturday afternoon, you'd catch us all on the same pickup truck going to the cotton field or going to the store, all in the same yard plan. And things began to change about the time I was in the eighth grade. Schools began to integrate. And the first thing I realized is that I felt a little different even from black people. Because we had an end of school year party that year, and they were doing some dancing and jitterbugging I had never seen before. I had never heard that kind of music. They were listening to Martha Reeves and the Vandellas and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye, and I had never heard that stuff. I had been listening to a country station out of Gaffney while I was laying in the bathtub on Saturday night, I'd been listening to Buck and the Buckaroos and Merle Haggard and the Strangers, and still like a little Weldon Jennings, you know. I like to spin a little Vern Gosson every now and then now, you know. I like to hear him cry about that thing, you know. These guys from Holyoke Park could dance with the girls. They could twirl. Now, Gwen Gittney was a big girl. They could turn her around and make her look beautiful. I couldn't do that. As a matter of fact, I was scared to get on the floor. And they had cool walks. Man, I tell you, all these black guys today, I watch them in the mall, man, they got these cool walks. They dip, but I didn't do that, see. I've been pulling that cotton sack for 13 years, and it just pulled the dip out of my hip, you know. And so here I am, I'm 13 years old, I'm black and I ain't cool. And I'm a soul brother, I ain't got soul. But we found something that would do the trick. That something. In my wife's grandfather's crib. A little liquid corn. A little corn liquor. I think it was a Kentucky gentleman or something. An old crow or something. Anyway, we didn't spend a lot of time reading it. We knew what we had to do. We had just a little bit of time to do it. And we laid out there in the corn crib, drunk grandfather's liquor. Got this tingling sensation. Started in my stomach, went on down to my kneecaps. Man, I tell you, I felt good that day. I knew before it even took full effect that I was going to have me some more of that stuff. We went down in the plum bushes, hit up on the plum bushes, and talked about what we'd do to those Bentley girls. They came over the hill, and they didn't come. We didn't get to do it. Threw them back up here. Back in the corn crib. And I'm going to tell you, I am not a man of courage. And we were sitting there thinking about what we're going to get back in that bottle and replace it and make it look like liquor. And all of a sudden, Kale thought of the idea. I approved, and we urinated in that bottle, hit it right back where we found it. Never got caught for that. My next encounter with alcohol, I was going to make some myself, and I did. I boiled up some berries there and poured it up in two mason jars. Now, I knew nothing about making wine. But I made some that day. And I knew this stuff was supposed to ferment. Sit in the dark somewhere so alcohol would get in. Won't get in it while you're looking. Won't get in it then. It's got to be dark. And I dug a hole in the backyard and buried those two jars of whatever it was and went back and sat on the back porch for about 5 minutes and said, well, it's ready now. Now, what you got? And I drank that first one. It made my belly fat. I was riding around on an old bicycle, you know, waiting for the feeling to come. It didn't come, so I thought about that thing, you know. Being the genius that I am, I poured a little rubbing alcohol in that next quart, you know, to give a little fortification. And I drank that sometime later. Neither one of those jars produced a high. But that second one produced the worst case of gas I ever had in my life. Even that's better than being normal, you know. A little gas ain't bad if you live in Shelby, North Carolina. You know, fair don't come but once a year. You need a little amusement. I went to high school. I ended high school on a college preparatory track. I had no idea I could play basketball. I had no desire to play basketball. I was just having fun. But I was so self-conscious that once that gym filled up, I could not play. I was positively sure these guys are sitting in the bleachers saying, "Look at the feet on that guy." I was terribly self-conscious. Never understood that anybody else felt like that until I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I am fortunate. I am blessed that my alcoholism progressed so rapidly that within the 4 years of high school, other people had begun to notice. Other people had begun to tell me. I entered high school on a college preparatory track, and I drank myself out of the basketball program in about 2 years out of a school bus, off a school bus route in a year and 19 days. And I dropped from the college preparatory program to the vocational program, from vocational to general, and barely skipped, got out of school, begging teachers to pass me, laying out of school, drinking wine on Fridays and Saturdays. You remember that old commercial by Michelob where it says, "Put a little weekend in your week"? I started putting a little weekend in my week. Just backing it up from Friday to Thursday. And I was confronted by with my alcoholism about four times in my last 2 weeks of high school. The first one that confronted me with my alcoholism was Miss Lois Sauls, minister's daughter and my English teacher 3 of the 4 years. She politely threw me out of the classroom because I had some bell-bottom pants, and I didn't have bell-bottom legs back then. I rolled those bell-bottom pants up bikini style and cruised in the class, and she threw me out. Came back out with the big black book. Showed me my grades. She had papers from my freshman year and my junior year. Showed me my work had gotten worse. And at the end of that, she said, "Dennis, this is your pattern of laying out of school." I said, "Dennis, I think you have a drinking problem. I'm just 17 years old. I didn't know what to do. That hurt my feelings." So you know what I started doing? I started explaining to her how little I drank. I don't know anybody that ain't a drunk that explains how little they drink. Nobody else cares how little they drink. They don't even notice how little they drink. But the next three people that confronted me with my drinking were classmates of mine. They were 17, 18 years old, just like me, and the first one was Sylvia Spears, another minister's daughter. You know, that's what I think my problem is. I think I'm addicted to minister's daughter. That's what it is. Anyway, she said, "Dennis, I think you're alcoholic." And I never had, the word alcoholic really had never registered on my mind. That hurt me deeply. But Sylvia kept doing my history homework, and I just wrote that one off. And then Linda Lowe actually wrote in my annual, my high school annual, "Dennis, you're a nice guy. Stay out the booze and everything will be okay." That's hard to explain to Mama. That's hard. They like to read those annuals. And then there was Janice Morgan, who wrote in my annual, "Dennis, someday reality will hit you in the face and you won't know what to do." I never knew what she meant. I know now that reality she's talking about is accepting the totality of my alcoholism and living within the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time. It took me 10 more years of drinking to see what they saw. I often say that the disease of alcoholism is like having body odor. When the guy that's stinking finds out he's stinking, everybody else has known for a long time. Been avoiding him and talking about him. So during that 10 years, I joined the Army to get mad at my parents. You know, I just hated it. I was just full of anger back then. Didn't know it. I remember Lieber telling me, "Dennis, you're just angry and you're just jealous. Why are you jealous? Why are you angry?" I couldn't tell. As a matter of fact, I didn't know I was angry and jealous. But anyway, I joined the Army and spent my first six months in Vietnam, and coming back from Vietnam, Lieber and I got married. We had already had a son, and we went out to Oklahoma, and later on Germany, and then back to Oklahoma again, and spent a total of 8 years in service, and during that time I made rank fast and did prosper some. Coming back to the United States in 1970, I had paid off all my bills, didn't owe anybody anything. I had ordered the second of a series of big, long, silver Pontiac Bonnevilles that I just had to have. They were just good drunk equipment. You know, I used to wonder how the Highway Patrol knew that I was drinking. All they got to do was look at that car. You know, drunks have drunk cars. It's the kind with the fender skirts and the leather straps on the back and they're down behind and up in front. That's one. I remember in 1977 feeling pretty satisfied with life. I had that new car. We bought another car after that. We bought another house in Oklahoma. We already owned land in Shelby. Within the next 24 months, I would lose all that little by little. I began to drink uncontrollably as a drill sergeant. And the only reason I did not get caught is because I was a drill sergeant. Nobody questions a drill sergeant. But I sat there and drank myself out of the Army. See, in Germany, I had driven a car into a lake, a brand new car, as a matter of fact. And it was in 1976, and they had suggested that I needed treatment then. But if you outrank the counselor, you ain't got to go. And I didn't go. And here I am in 1979, facing getting out of the Army. And I'm in trouble with my drink. They wanted me to go to Korea. Lieber wanted me to go to Korea. Lieber's trying to get rid of me. I realize that now. She's counting on me going to Korea, you know. She's like, she might even suggest it to the Army that I go to Korea. But I'll tell you what, I might be drunk, but I ain't stupid. So we were separating from the Army and separating from each other. Bought her back in North Carolina. Bought her car back in North Carolina. I went back out to Oklahoma to spend my last 4 to 5 days in the Army. And I did. See, with those kids gone, Libra gone, I could drink with authority. I could drink like I wanted to drink. But when I drink like I wanted to drink, things start happening. I woke up while I was out there one Saturday morning in Hobart, Oklahoma. I was driving that car around in a wheat field out there, at the edge of a wheat field out there in Hobart, Oklahoma. See, what had happened earlier is I had barely escaped foreclosure on that house. A guy saved me, bought me out. I salvaged $4,300, I think, out of a $21,000 house. And sent Lever $1,300 of that money, and I took the rest of that money and woke up out of what I know now to be my first noticeable blackout, driving that car around at the edge of that wheat field. Absolutely broke. Don't know where that money went. And my lack of knowledge of where that money went was the basis for many an argument in our household until Lieber understood alcoholism and until I understood alcoholism myself. I just didn't know what happened that money. I came back to Oklahoma, back in North Carolina, like a good drunk supposed to, drinking wine and writing bad checks. Had a string of them right on 40, right on down to Shelby, North Carolina. And I got here and Lieber and I discussed this, and she said, well, I'm leaving you anyway, and she moved to Greensboro. I got another car and followed her, and I moved to Greensboro. Lieber got a job. I got a fifth. I applied for one job a day. They didn't hire me on the spot. My next stop was a liquor store on Church Street. And eventually I was hired at a local prison unit, and that's where things began to change. In 1980, I went home for a Thanksgiving dinner, and they began to confront me about my alcoholism. I didn't know it at the time, but they thought something had happened to me in Vietnam that made me drink like that. And I thought about that, and I think the only thing that happened is I had to go 6 months without some good Thunderberry wine. And I was just trying to make up. I woke up in another blackout. Somewhere around Kannapolis. I had started a big argument down there. Somebody, I think they'd asked me about going to church or something. But anyway, I got a second. I said, now, you know, Before I get back to Greensboro, I got to do something about this deal. See, Lever's uncle had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1976 and wrote us, somebody out of the family wrote us in Germany to tell us. And back then, see, Dan was the town drunk back then. You know, back then they had two town drunks. They had a black one and a white one. Well, Dan was ours, and I figured if they had caught him, it was just a matter of time before they caught me. So I said, when I get back to Greensboro, I'm going to call Dan and see what happened to him. And I called, you know, I got to Greensboro. I said, well, I quit now. But I think the miracle had already begun. Dan called me. Said he was at Winston-Salem, a place called Archer. Didn't know what that was and was scared to ask. And Dan came by, as Dan does. He took off his shoes, laid down on my couch, ate my Sunday dinner, went to sleep. I'm sitting there thinking. I went outside to look around, looking at Dan's car, and Dan had an old faded-out Big Book in his car. Had what looked like what I know now would probably be coffee and cream stains. And I checked Dan's doors, couldn't get in his car, it was locked. So I had to ask Dan about this thing called alcoholism. I went in and asked Dan about the thing called alcoholism, and Dan talked for what seemed like 2 or 3 hours. And finally Dan said, Dennis, if I dial a number, will you talk? I said, Dan, if you just shut up, I'll talk. I got to get this thing together before Lever get home. And Dan called a guy named James. I talked to James. James said I needed to be in his office at 9 o'clock, and I did. And I went down there and talked to James, and James was a strange guy. James was a black guy. He was well-dressed. He was clean-cut, had a tie, nice haircut. And he talked about his alcoholism. Gave me a little test. I passed his test. And I got to thinking, I have never heard anybody talk about themselves like this guy talk about themselves. You know, I'm a good old Southern Baptist. I talk about other folk, but I ain't going to tell you about me, you know. But James finally got to the point. He said, Dennis, if you're going to stay sober, you need this book. And that's what I wanted. It was the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted that so I could go home and lay across my bed and read that book and just do what it said and not have to make these meetings like y'all poor people. Because I wasn't that bad. And then before I could get out the door, he asked me a question that kind of bothered me. He said, Dennis, do you think your wife and your kids will come into counseling? Well, I knew they would. I didn't want them to. But I knew they would. Because see, the reason why I didn't want them to is because them kids, those kids were 7 and 9, I think. And, you know, when kids are that, you know, if you're not careful, they'll tell the truth on you, you know. You know, I don't want people down there telling the truth on me. And see, I just knew everything. I don't know why. I just assumed that I knew how this stuff was supposed to turn out. But I found out that I, you know, drunks know about everything except what they're supposed to know. And if you don't believe it, you go to your home group meeting next meeting night. Get there early. Park up near the front and open the hood of your car and look confused. You get about 20 of them. I said, man, look here, you need to get your battery changed. I said, no, you need engines. I said, man, you just need to trade the whole car. No. And after you get all that advice, just turn around and ask them to show you a driver's license. None of them got driver's license. But that's the way I was. I thought I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was. Didn't know. Lever went on into Al-Anon. And I don't know whether she got better or not, but she got smart. She'd say stuff like, Dennis, I'm going to a meeting tonight. And if you want to go to a meeting, you keep the kids. It's about time you do that type of thing. You're their father. And I'd attempt to argue, and she'd just take the big car and leave. She'd take the Bonneville and leave. And I'd have to drive, if I went anywhere, I'd have to drive that old Volkswagen with the brown nose on it that I had wrecked 3 times drunk and didn't have enough money to have painted, you know. You know, when you catch a drunk driving a wrecked car, you know who wrecked it. He did, you know. That's embarrassing. So I started hanging around these AA meetings. I felt sorry for y'all. Y'all powerless over alcohol and your life was unmanageable. I said, these folk can't drink liquor. That's what's wrong. I resented step 2. I said, now who's insane? I ain't insane. You know, I thought, forgot about those days. When I come home on Saturday morning, couldn't get in the door and just go lay down in the backyard. And Michelle would climb on top of that old raggedy dresser and look out the window and say, Mom and Dad are sleeping in the backyard. And she'd say, let them stay out there. And then I'd go get to the back door. And Libra has always been good at asking questions. And the first question is, why? Even today, it's why. Dennis, why are you sleeping in the backyard? And you know what my answer was? Everybody's sleeping in the backyard sometimes. Good answer. You know, because not once did I ever walk up, bring up to my neighbor in his backyard and say, hey, George, how you sleep last night? Yeah. But I ain't inside. I skipped step three because it had God in it. And my concept of God, that loving God I've been taught in Sunday school, had changed over the course of my illness. And I started writing on this fourth step that I heard y'all talk about. I don't know about y'all. I just knew a whole lot about step four than I did step one. And it was good for me. It was good for me. And, you know, I'd heard some about sponsorship. But I just couldn't find anybody black enough to sponsor me. Couldn't find anybody cool enough to sponsor me. Couldn't find anybody educated enough. And then if they looked like they were getting close, they were not a Vietnam veteran. But, you know, I got to looking at a couple of women there, and I thought maybe they might make some good sponsors. You know, I get close to them, they get up and move. And so you know what happened. I had to start sponsoring myself. Now, I sponsored myself for 81 days. Done a fine job. Done a fine job. See, the thing about that building, you know, if you're tired of people loving you, sponsor yourself. You're tired of getting home and that answering machine's full, sponsor yourself. Tired of going to those meetings, stand up late at night, let coffee give you acid indigestion, sponsor yourself a while. Man, sponsoring yourself is the easiest thing I ever done. But see now, and that built-in sponsorship is good. You know, he's always with you. You know, you don't have to worry about that call waiting, paging and all that stuff. Got him. I was left a meeting one night, and I had one of the brightest ideas I'd ever had. It came to, you know, dawned on me that there were some things that I could take that would give me a little buzz that didn't start with an A. Mm-hmm. I said, that's right. This is AA. This ain't MA. That's a big decision for a drunk like me. So, you know, I had to ask my sponsor about that. But he's right there in the rearview mirror, though. He's always with you when you sponsor yourself. It's good stuff. Huh? I said, now, you think we ought to do this? He said, yeah, go ahead. So about 2 weeks later, I'm up in Rutherford County drunk and about half naked, you know. Just me and my sponsor. And I done that day, or that morning. I said, it's a bad feeling. My sister drove me back to Greensboro that Sunday. And Ann never looked over there. You know, and if you knew Ann, Ann's just quiet. She just kept driving. She never looked over there and said, Dennis, what happened to the seat of your pants? She never said that. But Dennis, where's the rest of your suit? She never said. She just drove. And I'm glad she didn't. I didn't know what I could have told. But I did on February 1st of 1981. The only thing that I think I've done absolutely right now called tonight. I came back. When I came back, those old guys, those big veterans, were still sitting on the back row. And you know what they said? We've been waiting on you. Oh, man, I hated that. And they had a little conference with me after the meeting. And old James again said, Dennis, did you use prayer and meditation the day that you drank? I said, no. And that was the first time I had told the truth in a long time. And you know what I noticed about that is the truth usually doesn't take a lot. You can usually tell the truth in one or two words, like yes or no. I felt so good. I didn't have to worry about what lie I was going to tell to cover up that lie. And he said, Dennis, how do you expect to stay sober? If you don't use this program, prayer and meditation, the God of your understanding, it's apparent to me that you can't keep yourself sober. They told me a lot of other stuff that night. I left that meeting that night with the basis for my recovery. That night, I had the same package that I woke up with this morning. That night, I went home knowing that Dennis Nash could not keep Dennis Nash sober. I went home knowing that Dennis Nash could not replace his alcohol with any other mood-altering chemical. I went home knowing that Dennis Nash was going to have to effect some type of relationship with God as he understood him or as he misunderstood him. And I went home with the painful awakening that Dennis Nash was going to have to follow instructions from somebody that was reasonably successful at living sober by the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time. I started praying that night. I call them my porcelain prayers. I didn't want anybody to know I was praying. Didn't want the family to catch me praying. I'd rather get caught stealing back then than get caught praying. And I'd go in the bathroom, run some water in the bathtub, run some water in the sink, flush the commode, and get on the side of the commode, bathtub, and say, God, thank you for keeping me sober. Cut all that water out there. And then I got to the point sometime later where I started praying for the courage to pray in my own bedroom. Libra comes in from Al-Anon one night. He says, Dennis, and it looked like Libra was moving so much faster than I was back then. She said, Dennis, I've been telling my sponsor I'm going to do something, but I'm going to start doing it right now. And she got on the side of that bed and prayed. I recognized for the first time in my sobriety that prayer had been answered. And since then, we've been able to pray openly, sometimes together, sometimes at the same time, but most of the time separately in our own bedroom. It's no big deal today. Life changed rapidly and tremendously. Kids eventually went right on into Alateen. Libra would go on Al-Anon retreats, and that enabled the kids and I to begin to rebuild a life relationship. And the kids and I were doing well a long time before Libra and I was. And but slowly but surely, the family began to be a family again. And those two little nail-biting discipline problems in school began to settle down. Dennis made good grades until he got to high school. And then he made the same kind of grades his daddy did, you know. And Michelle immediately became an honor roll student and eventually went to college on an academic scholarship. And I remember Michelle being expelled from the school bus and on the honor roll at the same time. Now, if I could have done that, I'd have a PhD today. Don't understand that one yet, you know. And sobriety is, you know, it's taken me to several different cities, you know, getting sober here in Greensboro and moving to, taking another job and moving to Charlotte. It afforded me a lot of growth. I went right down there, and I immediately began to tell the Shuffletown group of Alcoholics Anonymous how we did it in Greensboro. And they didn't particularly care how I did it in Greensboro. And didn't like me. But I'll tell you what they were good for. I'll tell you what they did. They let me do some things. See, I had learned in Greensboro, but there are some things I need to do. See, the second time I came back, they did not allow me to pick a sponsor. They gave me one. And old Ivy worked with me from steps 1 to 3, and he turned me over to Lou H. Lou worked with me to step 9, and he gave me my instructions for step 10 and sent me over to AD. And AD worked with me from step 1 to step 12, all over again. AD done one of the most loving things I think one drunk can do for another. AD taught me what he knew of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. AD insisted that I do what I could to give something to the group. He insisted that I set up chairs, that I make coffee, that I greet newcomers. And one of my first jobs was to stand at the back door of the Stormout group and greet people. I told AD one night, I said, AD, I don't know anybody at Stormout. He said, you will. He said, meet me over there at 7 o'clock. And I went over there at 7 o'clock, and AD said, you stand here, and you greet everybody, and welcome to the Stormout group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, I felt awkward. Here's a black guy in the rich part of town asking, you know, welcoming people to a group that he ain't even welcome at. You know, I don't even know the name existed. You know? And I got to know people. As a matter of fact, I got to where I would do that whether he asked me or not. And I got to Shuffletown. You know, they loved me too. They loved me enough to let me make coffee. They let me mop the floor, mop the whole meeting hall 2 times every year. And then they real nice to me around Christmas time. They let me put toilet paper in both bathrooms. And the thing I really appreciate about Shuffletown, they let me pick up cigarette butts, and I ain't even smoke. And then they'd leave me there washing out those coffee pots. And I'd have to try to look cool stepping across those graves going to the dumps and into their trash. Did that for 5 years, and I got down to Greenville. I learned something in Greenville. When I got to Greenville, I knew about the central group, and I knew about the traditional group, and I knew some of the people who went to the traditional group. But I was sitting at the Keep It Simple group one Monday night, and this old guy comes in with a wet drunk on his elbow. I'd heard about it. And I knew this guy had over 20 years of sobriety. And he came in with that wet drunk on his elbow. I said, that's my sponsor. That's my new sponsor right there. And sometime later on, I asked him to sponsor me. And I became a member of the traditional group. And I've missed it because I've been going to school, so I hadn't been able to attend but one meeting a night for quite some time. Except the summer. But I've already got my schedule for this next period, for the spring, and I'm going to be able to make both meetings of my home group beginning next year. I miss that. I need people that know me. I need people that miss me. Because the most dangerous thing for Dennis Nash to begin to do is begin to sponsor itself again. Life has taken on a new meaning today. I have absolutely no idea where life will take me this time next year. But I do know what I'm supposed to do today. I'm supposed to live my life according to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's absolutely simple. And you know, it seems as willing as I am, the more I'm willing to live my life according to what you taught me, the simpler and the happier life gets for me. One of the things I used to look at when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is I used to observe other family members in meetings. I used to look at the way husbands and wives acted, the way children acted, and the way friends acted. I had lived in the illness of alcoholism so long, and I didn't know how to love people and didn't know how to let them love me. Slowly but surely, I began to get better at both of those things. I look back and I think about all the times that I sat around complaining about why I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and why I have to sponsor people and why I have to get people to sponsor me and why I've got to work these steps and why can't I drink just a little bit of wine and all of this. And then I think about people with illnesses like leukemia, cancer, AIDS, all type of terminal illnesses. And they know that they're going to die of their illness. You know, I think about if they had a program like mine where all they had to do was follow some simple directions. Directions like go to meetings on a regular basis. Get a sponsor that they choose. Use their concept of a higher power. Begin to use prayer and meditation. If all they had to do, those simple instructions, if all they had to do was like help other people that are recovering from those illnesses. If they had a 12-step recovery program, if they had a program covered at some of Alcoholics Anonymous, you couldn't find a room big enough to fill them up, big enough to hold. And many times I think about how I've sat right in the middle of the solution, complaining about the problem. And that's why I need to be here tonight, and that's why I'm looking forward to a wonderful weekend with you. Thank you all, and God bless you.